On this weekend recap edition of Baseball Barbacast, we tell you about the LSU Tigers, who won their 8th national championship on Sunday. What was special about this LSU team? Why is Cade Anderson going to be a high draft pick next month? And so much more from Omaha. Then we talk about just the one sweep. The Brewers, the only team to sweep this weekend over the Twins. Highlight a few other series. Phillies over the Mets. Dodgers over the Nats. Cal Raleigh keeps homering. Mariners over the Cubs, Giants over the Red Sox, and then we turbo through the rest of the weekend action on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello, and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world who thinks that Oklahoma City Thunder is a great nickname for James Outman. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman, and That was a little mean, actually.
I don't know. Maybe it was a compliment, and James Outman will become a legend of Bricktown over the years, or he'll just get traded and be a big leaguer on some bad team. Yes, the Oklahoma City Thunder are your 2025 NBA champions. My brother, who is a massive Thunder fan, is quite excited. Russell Westbrook is basically his Felix Hernandez for me. I know that probably makes people in Seattle's heads and hearts hurt to hear that, but my brother's a big Thunder fan, so I'm happy for him. Sad for the Pacers, of course, as a Midwest resident and former Indiana resident, but that's all the basketball talk we have on this episode of Baseball Barbacast. So much to recap. We only had one sweep, Jake. I know last week we had a million sweeps in a Rafael Devers trade. This week's going to be a little bit different. We are going to actually open in Omaha.
I am home from Omaha, as are the baseball teams, because the College World Series, the Men's College World Series, ended on Sunday with LSU winning Game 2 of the Championship Series over Coastal Carolina. We previewed the series on Friday. Coastal was rolling into the finals with a 26-game win streak. Well, it will begin next season with a 2-game losing streak as LSU took the first game of the series 1-0 on a dominant performance from Cade Anderson. Anderson is certainly in the mix for the number one overall pick for the upcoming draft. 130-pitch complete game shutout. Cameron Flukey was good for Coastal in that game, but they could not score a single run. LSU scores in the first inning. Nobody scores again. And the Tigers take game one. Game two, we have a bit of an ump show, which we are going to get to. Anthony Ionson, very good on the mound for the Tigers. They win that one by a score of 5-3, capturing their second national championship in baseball in the last 3 years. Coach Jay Johnson, in just his fourth year at the helm of the LSU Tigers, taking his second national championship, the quickest a head coach has ever been or has ever gotten to two College World Series wins. Jordan, where would you like to begin from Omaha?
So I think let's just do a little big picture LSU. I know when we talk about college baseball on this podcast, we try and kind of open it up and not get too nitty gritty. Although I do want to talk about Cade Anderson a little bit more at length after that performance. But yeah, I mean, college baseball nowadays, we know that this is, I think, 7 or 8 consecutive years that an SEC team has won. But those have all been different teams. And that's part of been, you know, the story in college baseball recently is how all these different SEC teams have had these moments. For LSU to do this, and this is sort of what I wrote about for the preview on Yahoo coming into the College World Series, is, you know, sure, that was 2 years ago, and it doesn't feel like it was that long ago that we were watching Paul Skeens and Dylan Cruz do this. But because it's college baseball in 2025, and because there's so much turnover, especially when you're a team like LSU that's churning out draft picks, this is a completely different roster. And so that's why I think Jay Johnson is such a big part of this story. To be able to rise to the top this quickly again, of course, LSU has the resources. They have the ability to bring in high-level transfers via NIL, via other, you know, forms of recruiting, and of course, getting these high-end freshmen. But you go back and look at that 2023 team, there's not a lot of players that were main contributors on that team that were main contributors on this team. And for to be able to have that much roster turnover and still have high-end talent, of course, they have the advantage of being able to bring in the best players, but for how chaotic college baseball is nowadays, it is pretty amazing that they managed to get back to the top once again. Maybe they didn't have generational talent at the top, although they might have a number one pick in Kate Anderson, who we can talk about. But that's what's so impressive to me, is that they managed to rebuild this quickly and reload, I guess is the word, this quickly, and to have this amount of talent just 2 years later with a completely different amount of personnel.
I was talking to someone in Omaha about Jay Johnson, and there are a bunch of different ways to try and describe why he's good at his job and why he is flat out one of the best coaches in America. And this is maybe somewhat demeaning and a backhanded compliment, but we're talking about a 5'8 listed California guy who got the head coaching job at LSU as a 46-year-old, right? This is not someone with like Louisiana bona fides or played pro ball or whatever. This is a guy who coached his way, recruited in some ways his way to this position and has succeeded immediately. And when, for me, like I'm thinking about LSU as what was like the sleeping giant, where yes, they were competitive for many years, like in the Alex Bregman, Aaron Nola era, but they didn't win that national championship. Jay Johnson has kind of unlocked and unleashed the full potential of this program in a way that Paul Maneri, his predecessor, felt to be kind of teetering on all the time. But Jay has just done it immediately within the first 4 years of his tenure in Baton Rouge. And I think that LSU is the premier program in college baseball, full stop. They have done the best in the transfer portal. And I would say when you talk to like really talented high school players, or like, you know, kids in middle school, even like LSU and Tennessee are the programs where like if you are talented and you're 14 and you want to put a logo on your wall of where you want to play college baseball, like I did when I was 13, except I wasn't talented, like you're putting an LSU logo or you're putting a, you know, a Tennessee logo on the wall.
Yeah. And I think this is a good place to kind of pivot back to Kate Anderson here, because what has been so impressive about both LSU and Tennessee, particularly in these last few years, is you do have the high level freshmen who come in both locally, you know, they're got some Louisiana kids, and we'll talk about Kate Anderson, but also the Derek Curiels from California. And you look on the transfer, you get the other kids, some kids from the South, and then you also get a kid like Anthony Einstein from UC San Diego. You know, what is so amazing about Tennessee and LSU is to have that combination of the transfer star power and the homegrown talent to become just a, you know, a superpower and just a really, really, really difficult team to beat for so many reasons. And I do think that as we bring Kate Anderson back into this, a Louisiana kid who, of course, you know, his dream to pitch on the stage, but for him to become this level of pitcher, this is the other thing. I mean, you talk about the coaching. 2 years ago for Paul Skeens, a lot of the story was Wes Johnson, who was the pitching coach, who, of course, had been in the college game for a long time, had come out of the college game. He'd been with the Twins. He leaves the Twins because he wants to get back into college. He's a huge part of the Paul Skeens development story. Wes Johnson is gone now. He's the head coach of Georgia. Now they have Nate Yesse, another incredibly well-respected head coach, pitching coach at the college level, who won at Oregon State and has had all the success at other programs. And now he's able to kind of help get the most out of a Kate Anderson, out of an Anthony Ianson, out of a Chase Shores, guys that, you know, have been with different pitching coaches and have had success either way. So I think that's what it kind of shows you how much is going right at the top level for LSU. Yes, we know they have all the advantages in the world and they have all this talent, but there are a lot of talented teams across the country, and LSU is the only one that's won two national championships in 3 years.
Stephen Milam is worth talking about. Milam is the LSU undersized shortstop from New Mexico. Remind you of anybody? Alex Bregman was Stephen Milam's hero growing up. And this is via John Eads, who is a reporter covering LSU at WAFB in Baton Rouge, interviewing Monster Milam. And Milam says that Bregman reached out to him. He said, "Congrats, man, you're a dog." This to me is so freaking cool. The idea of growing up, idolizing a player, and more or less just following in the footsteps, right? undersized New Mexico shortstop LSU national championship, accomplishing in a way what Bregman never did. I mean, he never won the full natty when he was with the Tigers. And he, in this interview, Milam references the very well-known play that Bregman made up the middle, spin throw to first, and says that he was in the building watching him when that happened. This just fills my heart with joy.
Yeah, I know. Monster Milam, one of the best nicknames in college baseball, and I know he's been one of your favorites for a while. It is remarkable that he could, and he's going to have another year, right? So he's a sophomore, so he'll have a chance to go back there and try and defend the title. But yeah, to your point, you know, LSU has had some great teams, but really, you know, they racked up those titles in the 90s. You know, they win Skip Bertman, who of course got a lot of deserved screen time after their championship, and Jay Johnson talking about his relationship with Skip Bertman, who's really the head coach, the architect of LSU baseball, when they win in 91, 93, 96, 97, 2000. Then it's a bit of a lull. Paul Mainieri does win a championship in 2009, but after that, it's a lot of close calls, and they never really were able to get it done again until 2023, when Jay Johnson comes in. They have this legendary team with Skeens and Cruz, and so be it. The last thing I do want to say, just because, I keep bringing it back to it, but I think that the casual MLB fan wants to know about this Cade Anderson guy because, yeah, you know, when you throw in 130 pitch complete game shutout in game one of the, you know, men's college World Series finals, and you were already someone who was pretty hyped, I think people want to understand what makes him special. Now, the irony of this performance in particular is, on one hand, of course, it was one of his best. It was a complete game shutout in Omaha against the team that had won 26 games in a row. You can't take that away from him. But with both the way that Cade Anderson talked about it after and the way that, yeah, I know we talked about it separately, like, this wasn't the best version of Cade Anderson. He walked five. He was kind of dodging traffic all day. In some ways, that made it more impressive because he had like a 25-pitch first inning and was able to still go the distance. The fact that he was able to navigate around so much just kind of mess on the bases. But it was, you still had moments where it was like, yeah, this is the best pitcher in the country. And to me, what is so impressive about Cade Anderson is, no, he's not up there throwing 100. He's not throwing up pitches that you've never seen before, like Paul Skeens. But the depth of his arsenal and generally the command over the course of his season, which has been better than it was in this game, is really impressive. You just do not see a lot of college pitchers with four pitches that they clearly have real purpose and utility with. It was so obvious that he was able to spot the changeup when he needed to right-handers. He was using that curveball to land for early strikes. He was using sliders for swing and misses against lefties. And the fastball, he was still running up there to 95, 96. The command was not great, but you just don't see college pitchers with four pitches, let alone left-handed, let alone up to 95. And so that's why he led the country in strikeouts. That's why he's in position to be first overall in this draft, or at least, you know, top 3-4 pick. Is he a generational talent? No, but I mean, he got a lot better a lot quickly. This is a guy who had, you know, Tommy John in high school, and that's kind of why the start to his pro career or to his college career kind of got delayed. He is a draft eligible sophomore this year. He was really solid as a freshman, but this year he really took off. And so, I mean, he's about as ready made of a big leaguer as you're going to find. And that's why, you know, you have Jay Johnson, his head coach, being like, yeah, his next pitch should be with the Washington Nationals, who have the first overall pick. And we'll see if that ends up happening. But whoever takes Cade, they are getting a very, very, very advanced arm.
I want to ask you about the 130 pitch complete game shutout aspect of this, because I think if you're a big league baseball fan with little context, you see the 130 pitches and you either clutch your pearls and say, oh my God, his arm's going to explode, or you say, why can't big leaguers do this? And it does feel kind of disjointed when Cade Anderson in 2 months, when he's pitching for the Nationals or the Marlins or the, probably not the Marlins, or the Mariners, right? And he's on a strict pitch count. He will probably never throw 130 pitches in a game again. He will probably not throw 100 pitches in a game for the next 2 years, I would say. And so it's like, why? That doesn't make sense, I think, to the casual viewer. Could you try and help reconcile that reality?
Yeah, and I don't think I have the direct answer. I mean, I'd love your take on this, too. It is a fascinating kind of level of dissonance where it's like, okay, what is that different about this? Is what Jay Johnson had Cade Anderson do this weekend reckless and shameful that they would have this guy who's about to be taken in the top five throw 130 pitches. Is this just an abomination? And I don't know if we had as much, you know, discourse about that this time. And of course, you get caught up in the performance. And of course, he finished the game. They won the game. They win the World Series. But it is interesting. And I do think even this year, we've started to see some movement. I know, Sam Miller has had some really interesting points about just like how starting pitching has started to maybe come back. The teams are being a little bit more loose with at least the pitch count aspect of this. Because to me, what I've always been uncomfortable with when we're talking about pitchers in college in particular, having their workload stretched to a level that feels uncomfortable, it's the coming back quickly. It's the coming back on 2 or 3 days of rest and throwing another 190 pitch, whatever. This was full rest, and if they felt like he was cruising, if they felt like his velocity was still there, I think you can find a lot of people within the community who study this stuff that what is more dangerous is not necessarily individual pitch count over an individual outing, but it is the workload over the course of time, or it's just velocity, or it's just coming back too fast. So there's a lot of things that you're factoring into it. And I do think it did not surprise me that Jay Johnson decided this is my best chance to win the World Series is to have Cade Anderson complete this game and have all the rest of my bullpen available for these next two games. And I think he handled it well, of course. And it is weird that we probably aren't going to see him throw. I mean, I think 130, it's quite likely we will never see him do it again. I think 100 pitches, when you build it up, I mean, there's a lot of things that go into this too. We know he has already had a Tommy John. Does that make us feel better or worse about his durability? I think that's another part of this factor that is a little bit difficult to talk about. So it is weird, you know, just doing a quick stat head here. Do you know how many games we've had 130 pitches in the big leagues, just in the regular season, in the last 10 years, or I guess since 2014, I just did this randomly. How many starts of 130 pitches in the major league since 2014?
2014, I'll go 11.
Eight. And really just one since the pandemic, and that was Alex Cobb in 2023, 131. So, yeah, I mean, it's just not something you're going to see. Does it mean that they can't do it? Remember, there's also a strategic element to this, right? This is not just about pitcher health. This is that major league teams do not believe their best option to win the game is to have their starting pitcher throwing more than 100 pitches. That's another thing we have to remember and is often very different than in college when Cade Anderson at 120 pitches is a way better pitcher than whoever's going to come out of the bullpen. So you have to remember that part of it too, but that's my broad take. I know that was kind of a lot, but that's kind of what I'm on it.
My take is a little bit more toxic, I think, which is like prioritize. Well, the first thing is the big league teams and the college teams are optimizing for something different, right? The big league team is prioritizing health in the long run, and the college team is prioritizing winning a World Series, college World Series, winning baseball games. There was a moment last week where the Arkansas head coach Dave Van Horn was asked, hey, did you think about keeping this player in? I think it was their reliever, Gabe Gackle. Like, hey, did you think about going to Gackle for a fourth? And he was like, I'm not doing that to that kid on that amount of rest. So, like, there is a level of concern now that I think is higher than it's ever been at the college level. The abuse of young arms is better. Like, teams are more mindful of it. But for me, it's like, we don't know anything, dude. Like, I understand that. Okay, so we know some stuff, clearly, obviously. It is bad to throw 100 pitches every day. But I just find it tough to swallow where it's like, we're hurting these kids. And it's like, okay, well, what are the Dodgers doing? Right? Like, it's not like the smartest organizations in the world have this figured out. I'm not saying we should run these kids into the ground, but it just rings a little bit hollow to me when I hear that take. And if this kid is capable of throwing 130 pitches, then he should be allowed to throw 130 pitches. I know that's maybe not a fully formed opinion, but it's like, if there was an answer, a definitive answer, I would feel more passionate about it. But where we're at now in the industry, I just don't feel confident enough in this. And I know that there are some people within big league organizations who are listening right now who are going to text me and be like, hey, dummy. Like, no, we do know some stuff. It's like, okay, I get that, but I don't think we know enough for me to bang my fist on the table and say Jay Johnson shouldn't be throwing Cade Anderson for 130.
Yeah, I think that that's a totally reasonable take, and I'll just double down on what I said before, which is that while it's easy to be like, oh, why can he do this? It's the teams are making these decisions based on a lot of things. It is not just whether the pitcher can physically do it. I am quite confident that Zach Wheeler can throw 130 pitches and be pretty good if you asked him to, but that's just not how the Phillies or how, you know, Rob Thompson, like there's so many other things that are influencing why pitchers are no longer throwing that many that don't have to do with can they do it. And so I think that's the probably the most important thing to remember, whether that's good or not for the game, whether baseball would be in a better place if we were letting starters go longer, if the risks are completely unknown anyway. You could make that case. You could say, is this really that much better that we're stopping guys at 100 pitches, even if it's not going to make them any safer than if they were going to 120? You could make all those arguments, but I do think it is really interesting. As for Kate Anderson in particular, I mean, it's her performance of a lifetime. It is obviously, hopefully he goes on to have a great major league career, but there's a great chance that that's the pinnacle. I mean, it's not to say that he won't, you know, maybe go on and win World Series, but to pitch a complete game shutout in the College World Series Finals for the team you grew up cheering for in your home state, like, how it doesn't get cooler than that. Like, that was unbelievable. So congrats to Kate Anderson. That was pretty awesome. And then the last thing on LSU before we move on from college baseball and start talking about Major League Baseball again is Little Rock. Holy crap. We talked about this during the when it happened, but the only team to defeat this LSU Tigers team during this postseason was the Little Rock Trojans, who entered the postseason as basically the worst team in the field and not only beat LSU handily, but like was beating them again in the final game of that regional and was unable to hold on. So raise the banner. Little Rock. I don't know. Like maybe that's a little, you know, okay, well, we didn't win anything. No. This is something that team should be proud of for an extremely long time. It ages even better and better and better now that LSU are the national champion. So congratulations to Little Rock indirectly for accomplishing something that even at the time was apparently even more amazing than we realized.
Winning a national championship and also suffering the most embarrassing home defeat in program history in the same postseason is really just a sensational accomplishment. One more thing on college baseball, we have to talk about the ejection, because this is something that I'm sure most of you folks listening saw. So Coastal Carolina, their head coach, Kevin Schnall, got run in, I believe, the first inning of this ball game. There were many debates online about whether he should have been tossed or he should not have been tossed. By the letter of the law, he went out there, he argued balls and strikes after being warned multiple times not to do that. And the rule is that if you do that, you get thrown out. There are two sides to this. Boot up the multiple things could be true at the same time horn. Schnall, in this scenario, needs to know where the line is. It is not worth it. Yeah, after the game, he was talking about, a grown man shooed me away and I need to defend my honor. Like, sure, bro. But at the same time, now you don't get to coach your team in the College World Series elimination game, right? And I think that he should have had a better feel for where the line was. At the same time, what the umpire did and how the umpire handled this, in my opinion, was also inexcusable, because you got to have a little bit of feel for the situation. Maybe I'm getting too macro. Societies are able to function in part because we bend the rules at times. We bend the laws. It is about the spirit of them more than it is the letter of the law. It's like if we followed the rule book to the rule, everybody would get pulled over on the highway, right? There'd be no drinking on college campuses. We live in a society where not every rule is upheld in every single instance. And I think that this umpire, Angel Campos, who used to be a big league umpire and lost his big league job, I guess, which is really difficult to do. That's besides the point. Just have a little bit more feel in the situation, understand what the moment is, and react and respond to it accordingly. I do not think he did that. I do not think that Coastal Carolina lost this game because their coach got heave-hoed in the first inning. I do think that the umpire went too far. I do think that Schnall should have had a little bit better feel for this moment. And it's an unfortunate way for this season to end, for like 26 wins in a row and a trip to the national finals is really, really stupendous accomplishment for the Chanticleers.
Yeah, no, I don't have much to add there. I think that I don't think I'm going to be more on the umpire side here, although it is also a situation where, you know, you say have some feel. Well, if this is an umpire who also threw out Cam Cannarella of a postseason game 2 years ago in completely egregious fashion, it's almost like you have to have some feel that the umpire you're yelling at has a quick trigger. That's not good. That guy probably shouldn't be umpiring the finals. Like, that's on the NCAA, and that's disappointing. But that's also sort of on the manager, or, you know, or the head coach in this case, where it's like, this guy's probably going to toss you if you go even a little bit far. So disappointing all around. Not why they lost, of course, but disappointing end to an amazing season for Coastal Carolina, who is obviously one of, if not the best mid-major programs that we have in college baseball. All right, we are going to take a break. When we return, let's talk about Major League Baseball. Why don't we? We'll be right back on Baseball Barbiecast.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbiecast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman, still us. No one's taken the pod away from us. Enough college baseball. Let's get to the bigs. One sweep from this weekend. How sweep is it? How sweep it is? It is sweep.
Clean up, clean up, everybody, everybody.
There is no shame in getting swept. I never got swept. You guys got swept.
You guys, the Minnesota Twins, got swept. A tough weekend for the Twinkies as they welcome in their border buddies, the Milwaukee Brewers, and kind of just get their butt whooped over 3 days at Target Field. On Friday night, Jacob Mizorowski, the rookie sensation, takes the ball for the Brew Crew and once again is unhittable. A perfect game through, I think, five or six. Unfortunately, one of my strongest baseball takes, you know this, Jake, one of the most important things in any no-hitter or perfect game attempt is how quickly the offense goes down in the later innings. And unfortunately for Jacob Mizorowski, the Brewers could not stop scoring. A five-run top of the seventh absolutely shatters Jacob Mizorowski's chances at perfection as he comes out, walks the first hitter, allows a home run to Matt Wallner, I believe. But the Brewers still win that game 17-6. Christian Yelich drives in 8 runs. We'll get
Jordan,
back to Mizorowski
to talk,
in a second.
Well, quickly on Mizorowski. He murdered Willy Castro with a slider. I think that
he did.
This is kind of related to Cade Anderson, maybe a little bit. Is like Cade Anderson is not going to be on Pitching Ninja. Like, you're not going to see videos of him embarrassing people in the way that Skeens got famous because he could do that, right? Mizorowski might be the new big league leader in outrageous swings and hitter reactions. He threw a 96 mile an hour slider, 96 mile an hour slider. The fastest I ever threw a baseball after trying to throw a baseball hard my entire life was 85. And it was only because I was hopped up on pre-workout and it was a fastball. Jacob Mizorowski threw a slider 86. I need to go check in with myself. Anyway, Willy Castro swinging and missing, tumbling to the turf in a pile of shame, unable to make contact. Mizorowski is straight up one of the most exhilarating starters in the game, and he will be facing off this week against Paul Skeens, which will just be, I'm sure, a slugfest. This always happens. It's like, oh, two great pitchers going to 21 win by two. Game two of this Twins series. With the Brewers, Quintana throwing 90 miles an hour, unlike Mizorowski throwing 175. 6 scoreless against the Twins. Brewers win that one 9-0. And then in game three, Brewers score in the first 5 innings. Twins start to claw their way back and they chip away. They make it a 1-run game, but the Brewers take the game and the series for the sweep. The Twins are now 37-40. They've lost 9 of their last 10. They had that really sexy 13-game win streak. When it happened, you and I were like, they did this last year. This doesn't really change the way we think about the Twins. I have no further notes, Your Honor. The Brewers, meanwhile, are now 43-35, 3.5 back of the Cubs in the NL Central, but right in the mix for the third NL wildcard spot, and they're playing some very fun baseball.
Yeah, I think that the Brewers, at this point, while the personnel has shifted a little bit, and there are still some parts of this team where you're like, how good are they really? And do I still think that they are going to catch the Cubs? Not really. They have enough going right now, and I do want to get back to Mizorowski here in a second, that I think that they deserve to be taken seriously, which is not a small feat, right? I think that when we talked about this National League playoff picture, I think that we were a little bit quick to, even with Milwaukee, start to kind of shove them to the side as like, they're not going to be bad because they're the Brewers, but how are they going to be able to keep up with these powers in the NL East and the NL West? And I think what they're showing us is that they're very capable of doing so. Now, it helps that the Braves are an absolute mess. It helps that the Diamondbacks are worse than we thought. But I do think that the Brewers are now showing us enough that even if they can't catch the Cubs, which maybe they can catch the Cubs, that they are going to be relevant. And we should not be super shocked by that. But I do think that it is also important, because the other way we've talked about the Brewers is thinking about, oh, well, if they're in the middle and they are behind all those other NL wildcard teams, would they consider selling? Because they have some interesting shorter term pieces that they could be flipping. At this point, it feels a little bit harder to see, but you know, I don't want to totally rule that front office out from doing something, as we know they've made some pretty bold trades when we feel like they are in contention. So we'll keep an eye on this Brewers team. I think this is a pretty impressive weekend, especially on the road. And I just wanted to say about Mizorowski and the fact that we're going to see him and Skeens together is pretty special. I think that when a rookie comes up and is this good, right, 11 no-hit innings to start his career, it's like, how is he doing this? Why wasn't he in the big league sooner? And that I do feel. I do kind of wonder what took so long for him to be in the big league, considering the state of the Brewers rotation. But at the same time, you're like, you watch him and you're like, well, yeah, how is anyone supposed to get a hit? He's throwing 96 mile an hour sliders. And if he's throwing just enough strikes, we know he is. We saw it in the Futures game. He had one of the most electric Futures game performances we've ever seen, a reminder that he has some of the best stuff on earth. And I think, like Skeens, that slider in particular, the way that we were doing this with Skeens' splinker or whatever you want to call it, is because it's so hard and has such sharp movement, it's breaking our understandings of kind of pitch nomenclature. And we're just like, is that a slider? Like, to me, I feel like I'm watching a cutter, but I guess Statcast is still calling it a slider because the movement that he has, and he calls it a slider. So yeah, Mizorowski is absolutely must watch at this point. And do I expect him to allow, you know, one hit a game for the rest of his career? Probably not. And we'll see if that command starts to back up as he continues to go deeper into games. But that is a game changer and such a refreshing change of pace compared to some of the other softer tossing Brewer starters who are very important and helpful to get through the regular season. But in terms of like, oh no, we got to face this guy, Mizorowski certainly kind of fits the bill there.
I love that Brewers Pirates on a Wednesday afternoon 2:10 start is going to be the hottest draw of the week. That fires me up.
Yeah, and I think Skeens, right? Skeens could continue. We're already like, oh yeah, of course Skeens. It's just that's what he does. We're already used to all the ridiculous pitches that he throws. But that'll be a nice showcase for both of them, and for Milwaukee to continue. Of course, they're playing the Pirates. Continue to be able to stack wins, and if they can get back into the mix with the Cubs, that will be very compelling. I'm actually curious when the Brewers play the Cubs next, because I want that to be close enough so that is a compelling series. Okay, so this is fun. The next time they play the Cubs is July 28th, 29th, and 30th. So right leading up to the deadline, we could have, we'll see how close it is at that stage. Then I think they play one more time. Yeah, they're in Chicago for 5 games because of a rainout recently in August. So that'll be pretty spicy as well.
Do you know what Paul Skeens' career ERA is, Jordan?
It's under 2 now, I think.
It's 1.91. I know we talk a lot about him on the show, but I mean, the guy's made 39 career starts. He's a 1.91 ERA. Like, this, we're seeing something singular here. This is preposterous.
Yep. Twins.
He's a career 9.19 whip. He's a career 9.19 whip.
Yeah, Yeah, pretty good. Good pitcher. And yeah, in terms of fastball velocity, that's the other thing. I mean, Mizorowski right now is throwing, we're used to velocity, but holding that level of velocity as a starting pitcher is still fairly rare. And both Skeens and Mizorowski are at the top of that list. So we will obviously be tuning into that later this week. Anything else on the Brewers and Twins before we go around the league, Jake?
No.
All right. More series to discuss. Let's go around the league.
We'll begin in Philadelphia, where the Mets were in town for three. First game of that set on Friday, the Mets lose stretching their losing streak to seven. Huge day for Brandon Marsh, who is like pretty fine again. He was one of the worst players in baseball in April. He has still a negative win player because his center field defense is much worse than we all thought. You know what Brandon Marsh's OPS plus is right now, Jordan? Any idea? Any guesses?
89?
97. 97. That is remarkably impressive considering that on... God, he was so bad. Just go look it up yourself. It's really great stuff. We also have an all-time highlight in this game of the double slide. Big double.
Yeah, this was to the wall.
Goofy as hell. Bases juiced. You got Real Muto on first, Castellanos on second. Double off the wall. Castellanos has to kind of wait to see if it's going to get caught. Real Muto gets to go halfway. One of those guys is faster than the other, and they end up sliding into home at the same time. My favorite part about this is like the speed difference between these two guys could have been a lot bigger. Like if Johan Rojas was on first and Castellanos was on second, I mean, they're going to hold hands sliding through home.
Yeah, no, that would be a full-blown traffic jam, but it worked out as the Phillies win that one easily 10-2. Then on Saturday, the Mets finally say enough, enough losing. We've lost seven games in a row. How are we going to respond? By hitting seven home runs. Mick Abel gets blasted. Poor guy. Two homers from Soto, two homers from Nimmo. Griffin Canning was pretty good, and the Mets win 11-4 to snap that losing streak. But still, with the rubber match on Sunday, and you know, first place still kind of in the mix here at the top of the NL East, we go to Sunday Night Baseball. Jesus Luzardo against David Peterson, and Luzardo dominates. He was fantastic. He's had some clunkers recently. You know, he was in that Cy Young mix for the first 6 weeks, had some bad outings. Now he's kind of getting back into his April form. He looks fantastic. Schwarber hits his 24th homer, and the Phillies win 7-1. Most importantly from this game, Francisco Lindor homered, and the Mets lost for the first time in 29 games, I believe, or I guess 31 if you include the postseason. This was a fun fact that even beyond Mets world had been tracking, that if Lindor homers, the Mets usually win. Lindor hits a garbage time homer late, and they can't obviously mount a rally, and so be it. The Phillies win 7-1, and they win this series. They currently sit one game ahead of the Mets atop the National League East. The Phillies have won 8 of their last 10. The Mets have lost 8 of their last 10. Couple interesting things from the Mets at this stage. They have optioned Francisco Alvarez, the catcher, to AAA. This might have caught some people by surprise. Of course, Alvarez seemed to be in that core of position players. You know, this next wave, we know they have their veteran stars, but Francisco Alvarez is a very, very important young player for them. And, you know, when you consider him in the mix with the Vientos and the Beatty and I guess Mauricio of that next wave of young Mets, this is another disappointing development. And I know he's still 23. It's not like he's doomed to never be a good major league catcher, but this is a pretty significant step back and a pretty big decision from the organization to option him, because it has not been going great. I know he homered over the weekend, but clearly they decided that he needs some work. He needs to be playing every day. You know, Luis Torrens had kind of been siphoning off some of that playing time. And now they want Alvarez, who's again at 23 as a catcher, is still incredibly young, I guess, to go back to Syracuse and develop a little bit more. So I don't know. This is kind of a strange sequence here. What are you, having been around the Mets more than me, what do you make of Alvarez this stage?
I think this decision is more about his defensive output and defensive chops than anything on the offensive side of the ball. Teams are willing to put up a lot from their catchers. They're willing to shoulder a whole ton of offensive ineptitude if you are playing well behind the plate, if you are stealing strikes, if you are handling the staff. If you take a look at Alvarez's framing numbers from 23 and 24 compared to 25, I mean, he's gone from a top five, top 10 type receiver to bottom 10, bottom five. Now, that is bizarre, especially for a 23-year-old. I would say that that has something to do, if I had to guess, with injuries, right? He was banged up to start the year. You could see that playing a role. But the Mets don't want to shoehorn him into the lineup at the big league level when they're trying to win baseball games, particularly when Luis Torrens is competent at the plate and pretty good behind the dish. So this move does make some sense, especially for a 23-year-old. No doubt it's disappointing, but I do think it is just important to understand. I have not been around the Mets in a couple weeks because I've been out of town and they've been out of town, but I will be there today. My understanding is that it has more to do with the defense than it does to do with the offense.
Yeah, and I think that the point you just made there is very relevant in terms of catchers, right? You say, okay, we can stomach a terrible hitter, a catcher, if they're a good defender. It doesn't really work in reverse. Like, in theory, if you can get awesome offense from your catcher, that's great, but you'd still rather have better defense than good offense, especially when you have other hitters in this lineup. More on Cal Raleigh in a second. Also, Frankie Montas, you are coming back. You're making your Mets debut this week, so that will be interesting. I know the Mets rotation has had some regression recently, so it'll be interesting to see what Montas can give them now that he is finally pitching for them. Let's move on to the Dodgers and the Nationals. Oh, boy. Game one. Clayton Kershaw against Mackenzie Gore. That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool stuff. Mackenzie Gore, of course, this breakout pitcher who, I mean, as far as, you know, highly touted high school, high draft pick left-handers after Clayton Kershaw, Mackenzie Gore is pretty high on the list, and he looks pretty awesome right now. But unfortunately, Clayton Kershaw was slightly better in this one, and Nats try to come back late. But they fall just short. Dodgers win 6-5. Clayton Kershaw, third win of the season. He now has as many pitcher wins this year as Roky Sasaki, Blake Snell, and Tyler Glass now combined. Surely that was the plan at the start of the season. Game two, James Wood hits his 21st homer. CJ Abrams hits a late homer off Jack Dreyer, first homer allowed of his career for the rookie Dodgers lefty. Jake Irvin was solid as the Nationals win 7-3. Then game three, we get Ohtani back on the bump. Once again, only one inning. Velo was a little bit down, not touching triple digits, only going 98. Didn't throw any sinkers. I pointed that out last week. Oh, are we going to see Ohtani throw more sinkers? No, it was all four-seamers, sweepers, cutters, a little bit of splitters. Ben Kasperias followed in bulk. But Ohtani got a couple strikeouts. Of course, he gets a triple and a homer later because the Nats bullpen is an abomination. Max Muncy hits a grand slam and a three-run homer late. Dodgers score 13 runs after the fifth inning. Once again, the Dodgers put Kike Hernandez in the mound in a blowout and still had to go to their bullpen. This has become my least favorite sequence in the entire sport. I hate this so much. Honestly, it almost feels like if you put a position player in when you're winning, you should have to wear it. He should have to finish the game. Like, we should have a higher batter minimum for position players if you're going to put them in up winning, because this is stupid. I understand the point. I know that Dave Roberts is just trying to think of the rest of his bullpen, and if Kike can go out there and get the game done when it's 10, when you're up by 10, fine. But own that. Have him finish the game. If you're like, this is so ridiculous that we're watching this over and over. I know it's funny when Kike goes out of the bullpen and runs in. I get that. But like, so maybe this is a grumpy take. Maybe Dodgers fans find it funny and it doesn't matter. I don't know. When this keeps happening, I'm not enjoying that.
I do not enjoy it either. And part of it is just because you're the Dodgers. You are this enormous juggernaut, and it kind of just makes a sham of the later innings. Even in a blowout, I understand it's probably more entertaining than watching Jack Little, you know, pitch in a 10-run game against the Nats. I understand that. But you're right. If Kike runs out there and gets cranked, he should have to finish the inning. A position player that comes into the game should have, barring injury, should have to complete the inning. Good rule change, Jordan. Very good rule change. One last thing about this series. You mentioned Mackenzie Gore against Kershaw. I'm just going to read something that someone named Jake Mintz, I think, wrote in 2018 at MLB.com when I ranked, or Jake Mintz ranked, the top 100 players most likely to influence the season. At number 80 on the list was Mackenzie Gore. Quote, calling any baseball player the next Clayton Kershaw is patently insane, insultingly reductive, and borderline irresponsible. And I would never do such a thing. That being said, if there's one single baseball throwing humanoid on this planet who could eventually earn that title, it's Gore. Here we are almost, I guess, 8 years later. And it's still a ridiculous thing to say, but it was nice to see these two guys sharing a mound.
It could have gone way worse for Mackenzie Gore relatively with those lofty comps. But yes, and then the other Dodgers thing to mention is that Tyler Glasnow is actually pitching again. He pitched in AAA. Roki's throwing a baseball again. Blake Snell's maybe facing hitters soon. So we will see what this Dodgers rotation looks like in a few weeks. We say that basically every day. All right, let's go to Chicago. Oh, boy. Seattle Mariners taking 2 out of 3 over the Cubbies. This Cal Raleigh fella, he keeps hitting home runs. He hits 2 on Friday to get to 29. Mitch Garver also homers twice on Friday as the Mariners win 9-4. Cubs bullpen looking like they're pitching in April again. Game 2, Emerson Hancock, poor guy, pitching on a windy day at Wrigley. Not great. 4 homers allowed, including 2 to Ian Happ. PCA hits his 21st homer. Cal homers again, 30th of the year. But the Cubs win that one 10-7. Then on Sunday, more offense. Oh, my goodness. Donovan Solano goes off. He has 3 hits for the 3rd straight game. 2 homers for Donnie Barrels, who survived the decision to DFA someone for the Mariners roster when Luke Raley returned. They DFA'd Rowdy, kept Solano, and that's looking good so far. Say Suzuki makes 2 errors and hits 2 homers. That's Say Suzuki, everyone. Kyle Tucker is hitting up. Kyle Tucker is heating up again. He had a brief little moment there in early June where he was looking not so awesome. He looks great again. But the Mariners cruise in this one as the Cubs pitching was very bad. Mariners win 14-6. Mariners head to Minnesota for 4 this week. Cubs about to face the Cardinals for the first time the entire season. They've got 4 games in St. Louis. Before we move on to Giants and Red Sox, Jake, Cal Raleigh has 31 home runs. It is not even July yet. He is a catcher. He is amazing. He is homering from the left side. He's homering from the right side. We are now just going to do the same thing where we're like, well, Aaron Judge is the MVP, but this is kind of interesting, just as we did with Bobby Witt last year. I mean, I will note, going back and looking at where we were at a year ago, at this stage a year ago, Gunner was actually ahead of Bobby Witt. Offensively and just in general, and like the WAR leaderboards, and Gunner and Bobby were kind of neck and neck, and then Bobby, of course, kind of pulled away. Not that Gunner didn't finish with an amazing season, but we were, of course, August and September, we were just talking about Bobby Witt as the only legitimate threat for Aaron Judge. Listen, Aaron Judge is still offensively across the line, way ahead. I know Cal Raleigh has more home runs. The WRC Plus, while Cal Raleigh's is approaching 200 now, is still a good bit behind Aaron Judge, but just as we kind of did with Bobby Witt last year, where it was like, well, Bobby Witt's playing a damn good shortstop. I will note that Cal Raleigh's defense at catcher has seemingly gone down a little bit this year. But in this case, you know what? That's just fine because he has 31 home runs and is still catching most of the time. And we know he's still, you know, the captain of the staff and everything. And even if he's not controlling the running game as well, the framing's still good. And I mean, it's one of the most amazing seasons we've ever seen. He's on pace to have one of the greatest catcher seasons ever. And yeah, holy crap. He's amazing.
I think Cal Raleigh has a better chance to top Aaron Judge than Bobby Witt Jr. did last year. And I think there are 2 reasons for this. 1, you see him on every play. Bobby Witt Jr. impacts the game defensively at the most important infield position and is capable of making unbelievable defensive plays at shortstop. Sure. Cal Raleigh, when you watch a Mariners game, he's on TV. He's on TV all the time. And I don't think that that is insignificant. The second reason, home runs. He hits a lot of home runs. And when you look and you compare Aaron Judge and Bobby Witt Jr. last year, it was like, oh, well, Bobby Witt Jr. has a higher batting average than Aaron Judge. And that's what he does. Like, Bobby Jr. is a batting average guy and Judge is the homer guy. And like, Judge should win. If Cal Raleigh has more homers than Judge at the end of the year, I think he has a legitimate chance to win the MVP. Who do I think will win the MVP? Aaron Judge. I was thinking to myself, you know, Judge hasn't been as good in June. He's had a 971 OPS in June. He's just said he hasn't been.
That's not as good.
Not as good.
It's true. He hasn't been as good.
So, yeah, like, I think Cal will finish a delightful second. I think he has a chance.
I mean, can he get a vote, right? I mean, Bobby Witt, we thought, I really did think that Bobby Witt was going to get at least a vote last year. Or at least I did until maybe the last couple weeks, and then I accepted. But, you know, it's just amazing. So Mariners are lucky to have him, and nice little extension they got done with this Raleigh fella, which credit to him, credit to the organization, and he will be the catcher for a long time and is, I guess, at this point, just like on a Hall of Fame track. I mean, no other catchers have had this amount of power in their career at this stage, even really anywhere close, let alone one season. I mean, this is his third straight year with 30 homers as a catcher. So, but that's a conversation for 10 years from now. Cal Raleigh, you are incredible. One more series before we take a break, Jake. We got to mention what happened in San Francisco, where Rafael Devers played his old friends. Oh, boy. Are we surprised that Rafael Devers hit a home run? No, of course we're not. But on Friday, Rafi went 0-for-5 as the Red Sox win 7-5. Seydon Rafaela had a big game in that one. But in game two on Saturday, you knew Rafael Devers. I'm sure he has hit this exact home run against Brian Baio on the Fort Myers backfields at some point, where Baio throws a fastball, you know, the sinker away. And Rafi's like, great, I don't need the Green Monster anymore. I can hit it out to left anywhere. An absolute laser beam to left field. As Devers, yeah, it was awesome. Homers. Red Sox rally late against Oval, falls short. Giants win that one 3-2. Then on Sunday, just kind of a messy game all around. We had Duran getting called out on a sketchy replay in the eighth where it seemed like he was safe. He was called out. Didn't look as egregious as Duran and Alex Cora made it seem to be. But either way, I don't think that's why they lost. Their bullpen after Luke Giolito was not very good. They allowed Casey Schmidt to have 4 hits. He has been quite good recently, but that's still not an awesome sign for your pitching staff. And though Romy and Ref Snyder and Rafaela have been very good offensively, the Red Sox pitching continues to be fairly inconsistent as the Giants win this series finale 9-5. And the Red Sox are still just kind of a drama-filled situation who are unfortunately not being documented by Netflix cameras this season.
Biggest loss of the year is that reality that we don't get the behind the scenes of this, and instead we get like Tyler O'Neill hanging out with his kids. Damn,
so close. Netflix. All right, we are going to take a break. When we return, we turbo mode through the rest of the weekend.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Not a whole lot of time left, but a lot of baseball to get through. Let's go fast.
Faster than fast, quicker than quick. I am lightning.
I feel the need for speed.
It's turbo time.
Let's begin out west in San Diego, where the Padres took 2 out of 3 over the Royals. Game one was fun. It was the Apple TV game. Bobby Witt goes deep. Jonathan India, 3-run homer. Padres battle back. Royals pull back ahead. That was great. Game two, Padres take that one. And then game three, we had a Jack Caglione home run rob of Jackson Merrill in a tie game late to preserve the 2-2 tie. Padres end up pushing one across on a walk-off fielder's choice in the ninth. They win 3-2. The other little news in Padre land is that Jason Hayward has been DFA'd. The bottom of the Padres lineup right now is very odd and bizarre. Yes, I know Jose Iglesias had a nice game on Sunday. I'm not sure he's the answer. We are watching a whole lot of Trenton Brooks and Bryce Johnson right now for a team that's trying to win the World Series.
The Rays take 2 out of 3 over the Tigers, who are one of the best teams in baseball. So that's a pretty good series for Tampa. They score 14 runs on Friday. They crush Jack Flaherty, win that one 14-8. Three more Rays homers on Saturday, including Junior Caminero's 18th. Junior Caminero goes yard again on Sunday, but the Tigers bounce back and win that one behind a solid Casey Mize start. Forrest Whitley is on the Rays now. He allowed 6 runs without recording an out. Not great, but hey, the Rays have been playing some pretty nice ball, and as someone who picked them to be the first wild card in the American League, I'm feeling mildly smart on this Monday morning.
Once I find out what it's like to feel mildly smart, I will let you know. Astros taking 2 out of 3 over the Angels. Hunter Brown and Zach Neto get into it in game 1. Brown plunks Neto. Neto standing on the dish. Brown says, hey, get off the plate. Neto says, this is the second time you hit me. Can both people be right? I don't know. Christian Moore hits his first career homer to tie it late, but the Astros go ahead in extras and win that one 3-2. Angels, huge win on Saturday, 9-1. 2 homers from Logan Ohapi. He is one of the streakier hitters in baseball. If he could just get a little bit more consistent with the bat, might be able to make a couple all-star teams. Game 3, huge day from Mauricio Dubon with 2 home runs. I was watching the end of this one, and on the Astros broadcast, their broadcaster said, it's a double doobie day, to refer to Mauricio Dubon. And I understand his nickname is Doobie and he hit 2 home runs, but for me, a double Doobie day is something else.
That's okay. Jeremy Pena is ridiculously good. Astros win that series finale 8-7 and the series. Let's go to Miami, where Atlanta tries to capitalize on some momentum after beating the Mets, and they failed to do so because the Braves might just not be very good. Agustin Ramirez hits his 11th homer of the season on Friday. Didier Fuentes was impressive for a 20-year-old, but not quite good enough to beat the Marlins as they win 6-2. On Saturday, the Braves bounce back. They win 7-0. Grant Holmes was very good. Drake Baldwin hits a homer late. And then on Sunday, Sandy Alcantara starting to look a little bit better. Bryce Elder was not very good as Kyle Stowers hits his 11th homer and the Marlins win 5-3. So much for the Braves capitalizing on that momentum, sweeping the Mets. Chris Sale is now on the IL with a fractured rib. Michael Harris hasn't drawn a walk in over a month, and the Braves record is still very bad. These are the series when you are supposed to win and continue to climb up the standings, and instead they are 35-41.
Michael Harris has been horrendous, absolutely horrendous offensively. I'm curious if they send him down, if they can send him down. I'm not sure what the rules are on that contract. Someone smarter than me, let me know. Because he needs something of an offensive refresh. It has been ugly. Speaking of ugly, I went to the Orioles-Yankees game on Saturday, which was maybe the most lifeless offensive performance I've seen from a baseball team in person in some time. Clark Schmidt, 7 no-hit innings. They take him out. He's at 102 pitches. Gary Sanchez breaks up the no-no against JT Brubaker in the 8th. Yankees kick Zach Eflin's ass and win that game big. The Orioles did take game 1 in a nail-biter despite a Judge home run. Orioles leading for most of the game on Sunday. But the Yankees score a bunch late off Brian Baker to win that one 4-2. There was a really bizarre play where Jazz Chisholm ran into Maverick Hanley. I believe Maverick Hanley was removed from the game. Didn't look good. Adley Rutschman is now on the IL with an oblique strain. Yennier Cano was optioned. Like, things in Oriole land are weird. The team has been playing better for sure. They're healthier than they've been. Their record in June is competent. This was kind of an ugly series loss that they really needed to have.
Speaking of ugly series loss that they really needed to have, the Toronto Blue Jays also cannot capitalize on any momentum as they drop a series at home to the Chicago White Sox. White Sox win on Friday. Homers from Robert and Benintendi. White Sox, White Sox, White Sox. Pope Leo is loving it. Game 2. Jose Berrios is fantastic. Bo Bichette and Vlad Homer. that's the Blue Jays recipe. They win 7-1. Oh, are they going to win on Sunday? It looks like they're going to, because here comes Jeff Hoffman with the 2-1 lead. Oh, never mind. He walks Chase Mindroth. Of course he does. Chase Mindroth. He draws walks. He makes an error by himself. And then Miguel Vargas takes the lead with the double. Grant Taylor closes it out. Fastball up to 102 miles an hour. First of many saves for the hard-throwing right-hander for the White Sox. White Sox win 4-2. Blue Jays coming to Cleveland. I will see them this week. Max Scherzer returns to the rotation on Wednesday.
Max Scherzer, so far this year, has thrown 3 innings. Over under 57.5 innings on the year for Max Scherzer.
Oh, I thought you were going to say pitches on Wednesday. 57.5. Man, that's a great line. I am going to go slight under. We'll see.
I'll hammer
the under. I'm not going to tell him that on Wednesday, though. I don't think he's going to like that answer very much.
Max Scherzer being injured all the time now is a bummer. It's also understandable. He's 40. But the idea of Max Scherzer attacking like very boring rehab stuff with the same intensity that he attacks hitters is very funny to me, because Jordan, you've never done like PT, I believe, but PT is this very relaxed environment. And I like the idea of Scherzer just grunting and like in the room with the trainers. Makes me laugh. Back to our results. The Rangers taking 2 out of 3 over the Pirates. DeGrom sensational in game one. Touches 100 miles per hour. I love the way that DeGrom has kind of slowly worked himself back into DeGromness, right? It hasn't been immediate, but he's starting to look more and more like the guy we knew and loved. The Pirates' defense in this was an absolute mess. O'Neill Cruz, just low effort baseball activities on both sides of the ball. Rangers win 6-2. Game two, Rocker. Kumar Rocker looking good. Rangers take that 3-2. And then in game three, Bailey Falter outpitches Jack Leiter. Buccos put 15 hits on the board and they win 8-3. The Pirates are just still kind of lost. They have been better since they fired Derek Shelton, but not better enough. They remain 31-48. That is 17 games below 500. They have not really righted the ship. They should still completely trade at the deadline, and every series loss that goes by, I believe more and more that Ben Cherington is not the man with the answers.
They have more losses than everyone except for the Rockies. Speaking of the Rockies, they won a game this weekend, but not until Sunday, as the D-backs pound them on Friday 14-8. Eugenio Suarez hits his 300th career home run, and he's like, you know what? That was fun. Let's do it again. 301st career home run on Saturday as the D-backs win 5-3. But then the Rockies refused to be swept for what was like would be like the 15th time this season. Mickey Moniak, go ahead, home run the fifth as they win 4-2. Report from Bob Nightingale that Bud Black might be rejoining the organization as a director of pitching. If this is true, I mean, I both shouldn't be surprised and also, oh my God, Rockies, can we just try anything? Okay, sorry. All right, we can't do Rocky stuff right now. Tell me what happened in Sacramento.
We're like bad black. Guardians take 2 out of 3 over the A's. They lose the first one. Nick Kurtz goes yard again. 10th homer on the year for him. Denzel Clark makes another sensational play. Very bizarre line from Tanner Bibee. 8 innings, 11 hits, 5 runs, no walks, 10 Ks. Don't think you see that every day. Guardians win the next two. Luis Ortiz is good on Saturday. Slade Ciccone, 7 scoreless on Sunday. He's been good for them. Class A doesn't look like Class A yet. Like, he just hasn't been that same guy. Shaking the ninth does enough to get it done. Guardians win 3-0.
Last series of the weekend, the Cardinals take 2 out of 3 over the Reds. The Reds refuse to get swept. They still have not been swept this season. Absolutely amazing. But the Cardinals take the first 2. Pallante was good on Friday. On Saturday, the Reds bullpen completely imploded. They had a 5-0 lead. And then Burleson and Arenado homered late, and Yoel Pozo with the walk-off single in the 10th. Cardinals win that one 6-5. Matt McClain is finally starting to heat up. He moves back up to the 2-hole and homers. Andrew Abbott, his ERA is 1.79. Oh my goodness. He has been fantastic as the Reds salvage on Sunday, win 4-1. And we are going to finish with some news here, looking ahead to tomorrow, as Chase Burns, the number 2 overall pick in last year's draft, will be making his major league debut at home in Cincinnati against the New York Yankees. And first of all, I mean, here comes another one. We are now up to 5 players from last year's first round to already make the major leagues, joining Cam Smith, Christian Moore, Jack Caglione, and Nick Kurtz. And we'll probably get Hagen Smith at some point this season. We'll see if we get another one. But either way, I mean, what looked to be a very special top of the draft has already turned out to be as we get another major league debut. And Chase Burns is, you know, we kind of had talked about Jacob Mrazowski earlier and Skeens. And this is another example of someone whose fastball has been a thing since he was in high school in Tennessee, was always a hard thrower, but his progression from a command standpoint and from continuing to be able to hold that velocity and throw strikes and have a slider that is one of the best, you know, breaking pitches in the minor leagues and just gets to the big leagues as quickly is amazing. I think it's important to remember that the Reds taking Chase Burns second was a bit of a surprise in the moment, not because Chase Burns didn't have an amazing season, but because you had all of these other incredible hitters on the board, some of which have already made the big leagues, of course, but their conviction in Burns as a truly special arm talent has thus far looked like a very, very smart call. Now, we know that the Reds could certainly use offense more than they could use pitching, but Burns has so far been everything you could possibly hope for. And to see his development into a full-blown pitcher and not just a really, really hard-throwing kid from Tennessee has been really, really impressive to watch. And I think people are going to have a lot of fun watching him.
That's it. No more pod. Well, at least till Wednesday. I will be headed to Citi Field today and tomorrow to watch the Braves and the Mets simultaneously try and get their seasons back on track. You will be in Cleveland, where you live near, watching Max Scherzer pitch. And we will continue to talk to one another about baseball. Thank you to TJ Brossel, Andrew Hartz, and Colin Brennan for producing. Thank you to you, Jordan, for being my pal. Thank you to the listeners for being kind. You can email us at baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. Love you, folks. Talk to you later this week. Goodbye.